And we're going to switch to talking about contextuality. So let's get started. What I wanted to do was be precise about what notion of locality is being violated in Bell's theorem. So yesterday, we sort of talked about, you know, we had an intuitive notion of locality that was clearly violated. And so now I want to be more precise about that. So if you look at Bell's original paper, he defines two notions. One's a notion of local determinism, and the other one he calls local causality. So this is the definition of local determinism. And Bell talks about beables, this is a term he introduced as opposed to observables. So he wanted realism, and he thought, I don't care about what can be observed, I care about what is. So I'm interested in the beables. I've called those the ontic parameters. Real things. But let's call them beables. So the beables in any space-time region 1 are determined by those in any space region V at some time t, which fully closes the backward light cone of 1. Because the region V is limited, localized, we will say the theory exhibits local determinism. So the idea is that the causes for events here can be found entirely in the backward light cone. And in particular, if you take a cross-section of that backward light cone, then the ontic parameters in this region will determine the ontic parameters in that region. So it's an intuitive notion of how a theory should be local if you have relativistic structure. Now, the problem with this is that it's not sufficiently general to be able to contend with theories that have some sort of objective indeterminism in them. So if it's not the case, if there's nothing in the world that determines whether some event happens or not, so there's no determinism, then you might still ask, what's the content of locality? Can you formulate a notion of locality, even if, strictly speaking, you don't have determinism? So that's what Bell's notion of local causality is meant to do. So here's the definition. I should say that, you know, A and B are now meant to be space-time regions that are space-like separated. And C is some region that closes off the backward light cone of A. So a theory will be said to be locally causal if the probabilities for the values of local beables in a space-time region A are unaltered by specification of values of local beables in a space-time region B. So rather than talking about the actual value of the beables in A, Bell's now talking about the probabilities of those values and asking what they depend on. And what he's saying is that if you condition on region B. Let me continue. Let me read the rest of the quote. So the values of local beables in A are unaltered by specification of values of local beables in B when what happens in the backward light cone of A is already sufficiently specified, for example, by a full specification of local beables in the space-time region C. So the idea is that if you specify stuff in C, then you might only have probabilities of what's going to happen in A. You might not have a deterministic prediction about what's going to happen in A. But if you specify what's in C and then you furthermore specify what's in B, you add that extra information, you won't update your probabilities about what's happening in A. So it's telling you that stuff that's going on in B will not teach you anything about what's going to happen in A beyond what you already knew by virtue of knowing what was going on in C. So mathematically, you can write it like this. The probability of some event in region A, given an event in region B, and given a sufficient specification of what's happening in C, I'll call that lambda C, that's the same as the probability of XA given lambda C. The conditioning on stuff in B doesn't change those probabilities. So maybe I should pause and ask whether people are happy with this notion of locality. Does this capture your intuition about what a local theory should be? Pretty happy? Okay, good. All right, let's apply this locality condition to the case of the Bell experiment and see what we get. So now I'll be interested in 4 parameters. So I imagine that there's some event that creates the pair of particles. They travel off to the respective labs of Alice and Bob where they're going to be measured. And then there's some parameter that determines what choice of measurement is being made in Alice's lab, what measurement is being made in Bob's lab. So that's little a and little b. And then there's some outcome that's registered here and some outcome here. I'll call those capital A and capital B. And so local causality tells me that even though the probability of the outcome on the left may not be determined by anything in the world, so it could be that you have objective indeterminism, even though we're allowing hidden variables. Lambda here is going to denote hidden variables. Okay, so even though we allow hidden variables, people sometimes consider hidden variable models that still are not deterministic. Determinism was not the only motivation for introducing hidden variables. So you can apply Bell's criterion of local causality even to those general kinds of theories, and it says that the probability of the outcome in Alice's lab, given the setting in Alice's lab, the setting in Bob's lab, the outcome in Bob's lab, and the hidden variables, is the same as the probability of the outcome in Alice's lab, given just her setting and the hidden variables. It should be independent of the stuff that's going on over here in this space-time region. And the reason is because lambda is meant to be a sufficient specification, and so it's going to screen off any extra information about what's going on over here. So any correlations that might exist between, for example, the outcome here and the outcome there is going to be screened off by lambda. It's going to be fixed by lambda. So if you condition on lambda, you don't need to condition on B. That's the idea. So you have a, yes?
So this is basically, you're saying what Bell's idea of local causality should tell us.
Yeah.
But why is lambda also kind of going into the backward light cone of B, which is not coincident with the backward light cone of A?
You can treat lambda in different ways, but think about the game we played yesterday, where the two contestants are allowed to have kind of local instruction sets. They're allowed to agree on a strategy. So in a sense, they sort of, all the information that one has is exactly the same as all the information the other has. They might have a description of their entire strategy. Each one of them has it. So in that sense, both particles can have access to lambda, some classical set of instructions.
Right,
yep.
Yeah, but that lambda would belong to a region where the backward light cone of A and B would coincide, right? Rather than something which...
True. What you can do is, if you demand that lambda is independent of little a and little b, the choice of settings. I mean, that's, I haven't written that assumption down, but that's actually the critical assumption. Then you can still derive the Bell inequality. So the point is that if the preparation of the particles has no information about what settings they're going to encounter, then it doesn't really matter where you think of that information as living in space-time. Conditioning on that information is not going to be enough to violate a Bell inequality. So, yeah, I think it probably would have been better if I'd written down explicitly the assumption about the dependence between the probability over little a, little b, and lambda factorizes into a probability over little a, probability over little b, probability over lambda. Other questions? Yes? Setting, in the one we played yesterday, there was like this S and T, two possible measurements. And in the quantum version of it, there was a measurement along the Z-spin axis or along the X-spin axis. So the setting is meant to be that the choice of the measurement. Okay, so to get from Bell's notion of local causality to a derivation of the Bell inequality, the critical step is deriving this formula, which is called factorizability. Okay, so what factorizability says is that if you look at the probability of outcomes on the left and outcomes on the right, so this is where the correlations live in those joint probabilities. If you look at those probabilities conditioned on the settings on the left and the right and on the hidden variables, then it factorizes into the probability of getting outcome A given the setting on the left and the hidden variables, and the same for B. So again, the idea is that these things form a Markov chain, that capital A and capital B respond to the hidden variables. So there may be correlations between capital A and capital B, but it's mediated by the hidden variables. So like the game yesterday, there might be correlations in the strategies, but it's mediated by the local instruction set. So they, you know, each of the contestants carries with them a memory of, you know, what the strategy is, what the protocol is. And therefore, if you know what their strategy is, if you condition on that, then you can say how each of them is going to act. And if you give extra information about how the second person acts, that's not going to give you any more predictability about how the first person is going to act once you know what their strategy is. So that's what this says. So I'm going to derive for you factorizability from local causality. So it's just an application of classical probability theory. So remember Bayes' rule. The probability of A and B is the probability of A given B times the probability of B. If I condition on C, then it doesn't change. I can just leave C on the right-hand side of the conditional throughout the whole equation, and it's still true. And therefore, if I look at this quantity here, the one we're interested in, I can just break it up into the probability of A now given all of these variables times the probability of B alone given all these. So these three are like C. They're remaining on the right of the conditional the whole way through, and I'm just applying this equation. And then by local causality, you know that this first term, the outcome on the left depends only on the setting on the left. And for the second term, the outcome on the right depends only on the setting on the right. And so then you have your factorizability condition. So really, factorizability is just an equivalent way of expressing the condition of local causality. So this was the Bell inequality we talked about last time. It turns out that if you go to the literature, it's more frequent to see it in a different form, which is you define a correlation function, which is plus one if you get agreement for two settings, and minus one if you get disagreement. So for any pair of settings, you can calculate the expectation value of this correlation function somewhere between plus one and minus one. And then what you can show is that this particular sum of correlations for the two possible settings, A and A prime, and the two possible settings, B and B prime, so there's four choices of two settings, this particular combination has to be less than or equal to two. And that's actually the original form in which this Bell inequality was derived. It was done in a paper by Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, and Holt. And it's equivalent to this form. You'll just see it more often written in this form. It's called the CHSH inequality. It's basically the most common one that's discussed in the literature. And so I'm not going to take you to show you the equivalence of these two things. You're going to do that this afternoon in tutorial. But it's not. It's just algebra to get from here to here. And what you're also going to show, I guess this is the key point, is that this condition of factorizability here can be used to derive these inequalities. And so you're going to go through the mathematics that starts with factorizability and gets you to those inequalities. But you basically already know the intuitions behind it from yesterday. Now you're just going to see, kind of, if you like technical developments, you'll see the technical development from the mathematical condition to the inequality. Good. So what else is there to say about this? I think that before I move on to applications, let me say one other thing, which is we were talking about different notions of locality. And sometimes people argue that, you know, this notion of locality is too strong, that really we should just have no signaling faster than the speed of light. That's the only reasonable notion of locality. So I wanted to contrast those two things. If you're an operationalist, then you might be happy with no superluminal signaling as your fundamental notion of locality, because that notion appeals to things you can control over here, things you can observe over there. But if you're a realist, and Bell was a realist, he basically said you shouldn't be happy with such a notion of locality for your most fundamental theory, because ultimately you want to know whether what's really going on over here can depend non-locally on what's really going on over here. And in the language of your most fundamental theory, you know, the notion of observation and the ability to control something are inappropriate. It's like having the notion of measurement appearing in your fundamental postulates. Bell would have said, that doesn't belong. The notions that should appear in the fundamental postulates should be about the fundamental systems and their properties. And similarly, he would say about locality, I should be able to talk about the beables, what really exists, and whether they depend on one another. And any attempt to try to come up with a definition that refers to what you can control in the lab and what you can observe is just inappropriate for a realist approach. So Bell really thought that if, he said, look, if you can't avail yourself of those kinds of notions, then, you know, what does special relativity say? And he suggested that, you know, local causality is the most reasonable notion of locality to adopt. It's the best he could do for expressing what the content of special relativity was for a realist. Yes?
Sorry, I don't intuitively see the difference between that and no signaling in relativity.
So no signaling would say, it's not that, no signaling would say that you cannot have, say over in your lab, something that you can observe, like the statistics of outcomes of a measurement, depending on something that I can control in my lab. Because, so let's say I can change the setting of a device here, that's something I can control, and then your statistics depend on that, that's an observable difference. We're not allowed to have that kind of dependence. But, for example, suppose your statistics depend on which outcome I got here. Well, I can't control which outcome I get. So that's not a violation of this no signaling criterion. So somebody who is only saying, if somebody said the only content of special relativity is that there should be no signaling faster than the speed of light, they could say, well, there's no problem with the dependence of your statistics on my outcome because I can't control my outcome, so I can't use it to send you a signal. Bell would say, look, the outcome that occurs over here in my lab and the setting of the measurement device, those are, again, just collections of atoms, you know, a particular configuration. You know, why should it be that the fact that I, as an observer, can control one but not the other has an impact on whether these sorts of things can influence the reality in your lab? Bell would say that's, you know, that distinction that we're making is not a distinction that should appear in a fundamental physical theory and in a notion as fundamental as locality within that theory. Or, I mean, he doesn't quite say that. He says a lot of work would have to be done in clarifying precisely what the difference between, you know, a controllable parameter and an observable versus unobservable parameter would be before you could hope to say that that's an appropriate notion of locality. Yes?
But, I mean, one of the things, reasons why you want to look locality in the theory would say because the temporal paradox, and that does require it to the distant things to be able to influence each other in a certain way. You have to have information transfer for that to be valid. Well, and I mean, special relativity, which
Okay, so you're it seems to me the flavor of your comment is maybe we should say that a correct kind of locality predicted by special relativity, or the only kind of locality that special relativity warrants us to assume, is the kind of locality that's implied by demanding consistency, no paradoxes, right? So if you could signal faster than the speed of light, then you could set, you know, you could signal instantaneously to somebody, but they're in a different reference frame, so they signal instantaneously back to you, but it arrives in your past, and then you set up a loop that generates a contradiction. And you're saying that maybe you can motivate the no signaling as the correct notion of locality on the grounds that it's the only one that's required to rule out those sorts of paradoxes.
Something like that.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure that would be exactly how I would phrase it, but
right.
Might as well go with that.
Okay, well, my response to that would be, you know, would we be happy if, you know, we had a similar kind of paradoxical loop set up, but it acts on hidden variables. So there's a variable here, it has value 0 or 1, I can't know it, I can't control it. It influences a variable over there, which then influences the first variable and sets it to one when, you know, the whole thing gets started. If this thing's set to zero, and I have a paradox. So you can say, well, we're shielded from that paradox because we can't observe the value of this variable, so we can never see it. But a realist, I think, would say, you know, it's irrelevant whether you're shielded from the paradox or not. We don't want a theory that has logical inconsistencies in it.
Yes, except perhaps you could say that, except for the fact that to get that paradox, you're introducing him.
That's what I needed to know.
To get that paradox, you're introducing hidden variables, which is your way of getting around the, which were introduced to begin with to get around the things involving
the measurement problem.
Maybe the issue is that you're going about that by introducing variables, you're going about that particular the concept of variables itself might be problematic rather than the concept of the particular conception locality. I'm not necessarily saying that that doesn't mean that the locality is wrong. It's just that particular locality causes problems. I'm just saying that there is another way of going about it, and maybe if what you see here shows that your original locality doesn't work, maybe what the approach is, maybe that it's the conception of the image.
Okay. That's true. I should say that it's, you know, Bell's notion doesn't rely on there being hidden variables. He just says, whatever you take the reality to be, the ontic states, this notion applies to it. And so if you think that the quantum state's a complete description, you can still apply the assumption of local causality. But it is true that, you could say it's, you know, realism is the problem. You could say that this is a notion of locality that's appropriate for a realist, and maybe there's something wrong with the framework of realism.
Well, with that particular framework of realism,
right,
but not necessarily a concept of realism in general.
Okay, fair enough. So let me say a few things about the applications of Bell inequality violations. So this is something that's only started happening really in the last few years with the rise of quantum information. People are now treating Bell inequality violations as a resource. You can do interesting things with them. And it's a really fascinating literature, all the stuff you can do with Bell inequality violations. I really like it. And I remember I was giving a talk on this, and I was trying to sort of figure out, you know, how to describe that research. And I realized there's a nice analogy. And I don't know if anyone's been... Well, it's... You read these papers, and what's happening is that people are using this very arcane, difficult-to-understand phenomena to do practical stuff. And it's kind of magical. You don't know, you have no intuition about what you'll be able to do with this sort of thing. So I went onto the web trying to find a definition of magic that kind of fit with Bell inequality violations. And unfortunately, it landed me on the Harry Potter website. But I found the perfect definition of magic there. So magic is a natural force that can be used to override the usual laws of nature. That fits really well. Because what I want to say is that Bell inequality violations, they're a natural phenomena. And they can be used to override the usual, i.e. classical-like laws of nature. And so you can do all sorts of interesting stuff with them that your classical intuitions would suggest you can do. And so the trick to come up with these new protocols is, it's sort of like you're coming up with new spells. You know, people have been trying to figure out, you know, what interesting things can we do with Bell inequality violations. And so here are a few highlights to my mind. So the first one is a reduction in communication complexity. I spoke to a few of you about this yesterday. So a communication complexity problem is one where Alice and Bob each have some data, and they want to jointly compute some function of both their data. So normally, that would require some, Alice will communicate some of her information to Bob. Bob might do some computations, send the outcome over to Alice. And there's a certain amount of communication that's needed to do that. Like, for example, if they, want to agree, you know, when's a free slot in our respective calendars. And it turns out that by using Bell inequality violations, you can reduce the amount of communication you need to solve those two-party computation problems. And if you have more non-locality than quantum theory arrives, you can actually make that problem trivial. You can get away with one bit of information to calculate a Boolean function on the data, which is very remarkable. Anyhow, the second class of things is about key distribution protocols. So secure key distribution is a way for Alice and Bob to set up some shared bits such that nobody else has any information on the values of those bits. And quantum mechanics provides a way of doing that. There's something called quantum key distribution. But it turns out you can do it better using Bell inequality violations. So Arthur Eckert proposed originally a protocol for doing quantum key distribution using non-locality. But what's been realized more recently is that you get even more security by doing this. So if the eavesdropper who's listening in on your channel as you try to set up this key is limited to not signal faster than the speed of light, right? So the eavesdropper could be more powerful than you. The eavesdropper might know the theory that comes after quantum mechanics and could do things that you can't do. But we imagine that in this world, one can still violate Bell inequalities, and it's impossible to signal faster than the speed of light. If that's what you know, then you can set up a protocol where you can be sure that the eavesdropper has no information about your key. And it also means that you can do this protocol even though the devices you're using are supplied by the adversary. So the eavesdropper might supply you with the very devices, engineer them to try to trick you. But if you can violate Bell inequalities and you're sure that the eavesdropper can't signal faster than the speed of light, then you can still be confident that your key is secure. So it's a really strong and striking kind of security. And then I won't talk about this one, but it was a great example of, I've been thinking about Bell inequalities for a long time, and I read that paper, and it just blew my mind. I just did not expect that you could do what's described in that paper. And yet, using Bell inequality violations, you can. And I'm sure I've left some off the list. There's a lot of interesting stuff in this field. Let me tell you a little bit more about one of those things, because I think it's particularly simple to see. It has to do with this security, having private key. And this is it. So one way to distill key is to ensure that nobody else, like the eavesdropper, is correlated with the bits that you're generating. So suppose Alice and Bob have a pair of systems, and they have these CHSH type correlations. Or actually, let's imagine that they have the perfectly strong correlation. So the game we played yesterday, they can do that with probability 1. They can win with probability 1, which means that they each have two choices of measurements, and they have agreement if for any of these pairs and disagreement along this pair. So this is like S and T from yesterday. The dashed line will mean disagreement. So suppose they've got two systems where they can obtain those kinds of correlations with probability 1. And now ask, is it possible that the adversary could have a system which is correlated with Alice's system in exactly the same way, so that if the adversary did two measurements, you'd find that the adversary's two measurements would be correlated for these pairs and anti-correlated for this pair. Okay, now, and imagine all we assume is that we can generate these correlations, but the adversary can't signal faster than the speed of light. There's no signaling faster than the speed of light in this world. But the adversary could be all powerful and be able to do lots of things beyond quantum mechanics. So we only assume no signaling. And we find that this kind of sharing of the correlations is not possible for the following reason. Suppose Bob measures S, the first measurement, and your adversary measures T, and Alice measures the first measurement. Then Bob and the adversary's outcomes will be correlated with Alice's, which means they'll be correlated with one another. But if Alice instead measures the second one, then she'll be anti-correlated with the adversary, correlated with Bob. Therefore, their outcomes will be anti-correlated with one another. So if they got together in a region that was space-like separated from Alice, and they compare the outcomes, they would be able to tell whether Alice did the first or the second measurement by looking at whether the results are correlated or not. and that would be signaling faster than the speed of light. Therefore, you can't share these kinds of correlations between two parties. So this just gives you a feel for why you can't do it. But if you really want to use this in a practical application, you have to go deeper and say, you know, what's the, for a given strength of correlations here, what's the strongest correlations I can have here, and how can you amplify the amount of privacy that Alice and Bob have? But this is the basic idea behind what's going on. Okay. The final thing about non-locality is something I mentioned last time, which is you can have stronger Bell inequality violations than quantum mechanics allows. And there's been a lot of interesting work recently on trying to find principles that get us to the quantum amount of non-locality. And so this is a trend in the program to try to axiomatize quantum theory using some nice physical principles. And there's been some good progress recently on trying to pick out the precise amount of non-locality. And that's all I'm going to say about non-locality, except for a few connections with contextuality that will come later. Tibor?
Is there any application of non-locality to an inflationary universe or cosmological things or something just beyond kind of these games that we play in quantum mechanics, or like condensed matter physics, or has people investigated those things at all or not?
I don't know of any. There may be, but they haven't been uncovered yet. One thing I can say is that for every frustrated network, so frustrated networks are important in condensed matter physics. For every frustrated network, you can define a Bell inequality. But I don't know what the significance of that connection is. In terms of cosmology and space-time physics, I think there have been some people who have talked about the significance of non-locality. But I'm not sure exactly what's come of that. Other questions? Okay, so let's move on now and talk about non-contextuality. So this is the lesser known of the two important no-go theorems in quantum mechanics, the first being Bell's theorem, which says you can't have a local realist model of quantum correlations. And this one says you can't have a non-contextual realist model of quantum correlations. So I need to tell you what that means. And my presentation is going to be in two parts. Today I'm going to talk about the traditional notion of non-contextuality. So what you'll find in most of the textbooks. And then tomorrow, I'm going to talk about a generalized notion that makes use of the operational framework we set up in the first week and generalizes this traditional one so that you can talk about not just projective measurements, but POVM measurements as well, and not just measurements, but preparations as well. So there's going to be a broader notion of non-contextuality that we'll talk about next time. But for now, I'll just look at the traditional notion. So here's the idea. Consider these two measurements. So we have a three-dimensional Hilbert space. This is a particular basis of that three-dimensional Hilbert space. The Hilbert space is, of course, complex, and I'm just drawing a real three-dimensional Hilbert space, but that's okay. It's just meant to help you understand what we're talking about. Here's another basis of that same Hilbert space, and it shares an element in common with this basis. So psi 1 is in common to both, but the other two vectors are different. So you might say, well, how should I model these two in my realist model? Well, what you note is that no matter what you prepare prior to doing this measurement, the probability of getting the first outcome here is exactly the same as the probability of getting the first outcome there. Because the rule for calculating that probability depends only on the projector onto this state, and it doesn't depend on what that projector appears with, right? It's just the overlap of psi 1 with the state that you prepared. So you have this interesting fact that the statistics of these two guys are the same. So one thing you might immediately think is, well, that's because these guys are measuring the same property. So if I think about some space of ontic states, lambda, then maybe the right way to represent psi 1 is as some indicator function or response function, which means that if lambda is in this region, I get outcome 1. If it's outside that region, I don't. And similarly for this measurement, And then the difference between this basis and this basis is how you carve up the rest of that space. So this measuring this basis might be asking whether you're in this region versus that region, whereas this basis might be asking whether you're in this region or that region. But this guy would be the same in both cases. That's sort of a kind of reasonable thing to imagine a priori, that that's why we see the same probabilities here. So the idea is that every vector should be associated with the same response function regardless of how it's measured. So this vector psi 1, regardless of whether it's measured together with psi 2 and psi 3, or together with psi 2 prime and psi 3 prime, it should be represented in exactly the same way by the same response function. So that's one way of describing it. Let me describe it to you in a slightly different way. This is a more common way of describing it, but it's equivalent. For every ontic state lambda, every basis of vectors receives a 0-1 valuation. By that, I mean, you assign zeros and ones to every one of these vectors, wherein exactly one element is assigned the value 1, corresponding to the outcome that would occur for lambda, and every vector is assigned the same value regardless of the basis it's considered part of. So the idea of these values is that they're meant to tell you, if I had my system prepared in the state lambda, so the ontic state lambda, not a particular distribution, but a particular one of those, and then I did this measurement on the system, what outcome would occur? So putting the one here tells me it would be this outcome, and it wouldn't be these two. And then the assumption of non-contextuality is that if this vector gets the value 1 when it's measured together with these vectors, then it should get the value 1 when it's measured together with these vectors as well. That the particular outcome of the measurement you get for a particular ontic state, whether you get the outcome associated with this vector or not is independent of what that vector is being measured together with. And similarly, if your valuation says you're not going to get this outcome, then in the other basis, it should also say that you're not going to get that outcome. So it could be that the one lies somewhere between these two. But if this one's 0, then this one should be 0. And if the first one's 1, the second one should be 1. So that's kind of a reasonable assumption. You might have said, well, that could work. And what was proven independently by Bell and by Koshin and Specker, Bell's proof was from 64, and Koshin and Specker's proof technically is from 1967, but there's some earlier work by Specker from 1960 that basically captures it. So they basically did it at the same time. It says that a non-contextual hidden variable model, so one satisfying that assumption I just wrote down, for quantum theory is not possible for dimensions of Hilbert space 3 or greater. So I need to convince you of the truth of that. And to do it, I'll use a modern proof. The original proof by Koshin and Specker is not very simple. So this one's not particularly simple either, but it's a lot simpler. Here's the idea. You have it uses 18 rays in a four-dimensional Hilbert space. I can't draw this Hilbert space anymore because it's 4D. The proof is going to use 18 different vectors in that space. And these 18 vectors can be organized into measurements in various different ways. So all the different colors here, so each of these points is one of the vectors, and all of these colors correspond to particular bases. So you'll notice that each vector appears in two different bases. Okay, so this one appears in the pink basis and the green basis. So this is like that psi 1 I had on the last slide that appeared in two different bases of the three-dimensional space. But in this case, every one of these vectors is appearing in a pair of bases. Okay, and now here's how we can see the impossibility of a non-contextual model. Let me write all the bases, right? So this is a four-dimensional space, so there's four vectors in each one of these bases, and there was nine different bases. So I've written them all out here, and you can just look at it, and quickly, I'm sure you can verify that these are all orthogonal bases. And furthermore, you saw from the graph that every one of these points appeared in two bases. So if you stare at this long enough, you'll see that every vector appears twice in this list. Okay. So now, remember, the rule is that for each one of these bases, an ontic state, so a state of the hidden variables, would specify exactly which outcome would occur were you to measure that basis. So every one of these quadruples of states needs to be assigned a 1 for one of them and zeros for the other three, saying which outcome would occur. So that means that there must be 9 vectors in this long list, all of which receive the value 1. But it's also true that every ray appears twice in this long list. And so assuming that a vector, you know, only gets a single value regardless of what basis it's measured in, then clearly there has to be an even number of 1s because every vector is appearing twice in this list. But that contradicts the assumption that 9 rays are assigned a value 1. And therefore, we can't assign 0, 1 values consistent with the criterion that exactly 1 has to be 1 and the other 0, and in such a way that the value that a vector gets is independent of what other vectors it's being measured with.
There's no deterministic non-contextuality.
That's right. So this traditional notion of non-contextuality incorporates a notion of, I like to call it outcome determinism, that if you specify the ontic state lambda, then that fixes what the outcome of the measurement will be. Tomorrow, I'll talk about a general notion of non-contextuality that extracts determinism. And we'll see that you still can't even have that kind of non-contextuality. So this is clear? Okay. This is the idea that if you look locally at your space of vectors, then you know, for any given pair of bases, I could always make the value that some vector gets agree across those two. But it's sort of the fact that there's sort of a loop and it has to come back and agree at the end that causes the problem. And so this is a nice visual allegory for it, that locally there's nothing wrong with this picture, but globally you have a paradox. This, incidentally, is the original Cochan-Specker proof. It involved 117 different rays. And this, every line on this graph represents orthogonality and every point represents a ray. I'm not going to take you through that proof, but that was the original one. Yes?
Does one have to prove this for every dimension greater than 3, or?
Well, once you've got a proof in 3 dimensions,
it's subspace.
Then you know, you can always find a proof for every higher dimension. I should say that Bell's version of this proof assumed that you could assign values to all the rays in Hilbert space and derive the contradiction. He used a result called Gleason's theorem. Gleason proved in 1957. And then Cochan-Specker said, well, you know, it's unrealistic to imagine that you could do, well, they weren't aware of that work, but they wanted to use a finite set of rays because they thought that's a, you know, more realistic thing to imagine, that you could do this finite set of measurements as opposed to all possible measurements. But conceptually speaking, I would say it doesn't make a big difference whether you choose a finite set or all. Let me give you another version of the proof that you can't have a non-contextual hidden variable model. This one's a little bit simpler, but the simplicity comes at a cost. The proof I gave you a moment ago, I didn't refer to a quantum state. It was just a property of the orthogonality of the elements in measurements. And it was independent of quantum states. It didn't use the predictions about quantum statistics at all. It was just a property of the orthogonality of rays. This proof is going to rely on a particular quantum state. So it's a bit like Bell's theorem. Bell's theorem relied on having an entangled state. This proof relies on having a particular quantum state. So here's the idea. Take a 3-dimensional Hilbert space and consider the following 8 vectors. And this diagram represents their orthogonality properties. So 1 plus 2 plus 3 is orthogonal to 2 minus 3. I've suppressed the normalization factors here. So there'd be a 1 over root 3 in front of this guy and a 1 over root 2 in front of that guy. But it doesn't matter. If you take the inner product of this and this, you'll get 0. And similarly, 1 plus 2 plus 3 is orthogonal to 1 minus 3. This guy over here, 1 plus 2 minus 3, it's orthogonal to 2 plus 3 and 1 plus 3. These guys are orthogonal to one another, and they're both orthogonal to the state 1. So this forms a triple, an orthogonal triple. Similarly, 1 minus 3, 1 plus 3, and 2 form an orthogonal triple. and 1 and 2 are orthogonal. So every line represents orthogonality. And the rules now are that, you know, if I have an orthogonal triple, then exactly one of them has to receive the value 1, and the other two have to receive the value 0, because were I to do a measurement of that basis, I would clearly have to get one outcome. And we're talking about the values that are assigned by the hidden variables, so it's deterministic. It's going to specify exactly which outcomes occur. And for any orthogonal pair, like this pair, they can't both receive the value 1. They might both receive the value 0, but you can't have both outcomes occurring. So those are the rules. And now it turns out that you can find ways of assigning zeros and ones that are consistent with those rules. So it's not like the last case. But you can argue that there has to be cases where both these nodes receive the value 1. And if both those nodes receive the value 1, then you get a contradiction. You can't color the rest of the graph. So I need to argue why those guys should sometimes both get the value 1. So first note that they're non-orthogonal in the Hilbert space. So that means that if I say prepare this quantum state and then consider doing a measurement projecting onto this quantum state, well, I'll always get that outcome. But I could also do a measurement onto this vector and then I'll sometimes get that outcome. Right? So if I prepare this and measure this, sometimes I get yes, it passes that test. So if I think about how to represent these two guys as response functions, so let me consider the two possibilities. One, that this guy is a response function that's disjoint from the response function for this guy. And the other, that the two response functions overlap. So whatever the probability distribution associated with preparing this state is, it's going to have to fall under the response function associated with this state, because that's the only way to explain how, when I prepare this and then measure this, I always get the yes outcome. So that distribution I've just drawn here, it always has to fall under here. But if I want to explain the fact that sometimes when I prepare this, I get this outcome, I can't explain it this way. If the probability distribution for this guy lies over here, then if I were to do this measurement, I would find that I never get this outcome because there's no probability assigned to it. So it has to be modeled in this way. And if it's modeled in this way, it means that there are some ontic states lying in this overlap region here that assign value 1 to both the response function for this guy and the response function for this guy. So there are some ontic states where if you measured this, you would find, yes, it's in this state. If you measured this, you'd get the yes outcome as well. And so that means that some of the time, I have to put ones here and here. So that's the tricky part of this argument. Was it clear, my explanation, or? No? Yes? It is, yeah. For any pair of non-orthogonal states, there's got to be some ontic state that assigns value 1 to both of them. Because otherwise, you couldn't explain this kind of phenomena that preparing one and measuring the other sometimes gives you the affirmative outcome. So we're happy with that so far? OK, so now it's quite easy. So we know that these guys are getting value 1. Orthogonal pairs can't both be 1. So for example, this guy is going to have to be 0. And similarly, this guy is going to have to be 0. So I put zeros in there. And the same thing here. This will have to be 0, this will have to be 0. But now I have a triple here, and exactly one element of the triple will have to get the value 1, and similarly here. So I got two 1s here. But now I've contradicted the rule that an orthogonal pair can't both be 1. So the way out of this contradiction is to allow that one of these nodes gets the value 1 in one context, and the value 0 in a different context. So whether I get this outcome, if I were allowed to depend on what it's being measured with, I could avoid the contradiction. But allowing such a dependence is a violation of the assumption of non-contextuality. Non-contextuality is the statement that the values assigned to these things are independent of the context that they're measured in. Good. I'm showing you different ways of thinking about this because I think they're all useful to have all of these different ways of thinking about it under your belt. So there's one other way that you'll find in the literature of thinking about this traditional assumption. And it involves talking about the values assigned to Hermitian operators. So let me start with projections. So here's just another way of saying the very same assumption. For every ontic state lambda, every projector pi is assigned a value 0 or 1 regardless of how it's measured, i.e. regardless of what other projectors are being measured together with it. So remember, I can think of a Hermitian operator as defining a set of projectors. And I could imagine two sets of projectors that have some element in common. And this is saying that the value you assign to that element is independent of which set you find it in. So I can think of it as follows, that I have every hidden state, every ontic state lambda, assigns a value to every projector. I'll call that V of pi. If I wanted to, I could put a little subscript lambda here to remind you that it's for a particular ontic state. And it's going to be 0 or 1. It's deterministic for all pi. And if I coarse grain, remember from week number 1, that if you say, I'm going to consider a new measurement where the first outcome of this measurement is just I get the first outcome if the first three outcomes of this other measurement happened, right? So I take my first measurement, which has the three possible outcomes. I put it in a box, and I output one from the box if I get any of those three outcomes. That procedure of coarse grading just corresponds to summing up the projectors. And so clearly, if your ontic state says, okay, you know, one of the projectors in your set does receive the value 1, then the set, one of that set of outcomes is going to occur. So that ontic state had better assign value 1 to the sum of those projectors. You know, the set of outcomes should receive the value 1. So this is clear, that you should assign a value to a sum of projectors which is equal to the sum of their values. And then finally, because if I sum up all the projectors in a resolution of identity, I just get identity. And some outcome always has to occur, so the value I assign to identity is going to have to be 1. One of those outcomes necessarily occurs. Okay, so you can express the assumption of non-contextuality in this kind of way, and then you can extend it to any Hermitian operator. So here's how the assumption looks for Hermitian operators. It says, if you have Hermitian operators A, B, and C, such that A and B can be measured jointly, so they commute, A and C can be measured jointly, but B and C cannot. So B and C don't commute. So what this means is that there's two ways of measuring A. I can measure A together with B, or I can measure it together with C. I can't do both at the same time, but I have a choice. Then it says that the value that you assign to Hermitian operator A should be independent of whether it's measured together with B or together with C. So that choice is, in this case, the context. Okay, so how does this follow from the definition I just gave? Well, when you measure a Hermitian operator A, what you're really doing, the probabilities of those outcomes are just given by the projectors in the spectral resolution of A, so the projectors onto the eigenspaces. And the eigenvalues, which I'm writing here as little a, I mean, that's just a conventional label for those different outcomes. So if I want, I can say, right, the value that I assign to the Hermitian operator A is just one of those eigenvalues. And which one is just determined by which of those projectors is assigned value 1 by the ontic state. Okay, it just says that, you know, if I did the measurement to this Hermitian operator and the ontic state were lambda, then I would get a particular eigenvalue. The ontic state assigns a particular eigenvalue to that operator. Is that clear? Yeah, maybe? Good. All right. So now if I measure A together with B, then really what I'm doing is measuring the projectors onto the joint eigenspaces of A and B. So I'll call those pi AB. And I just coarse grain over the B outcome to get my measurement of A. So I can measure the projectors pi A by first measuring pi ABs and then summing over the Bs. Or I can measure A with C, which means I'm measuring the projectors onto A by measuring the projectors pi AC, and then this should be a C, summing over the C index. And now the assumption from the last slide was that the value assigned to these projectors should be independent of whether you're summing up these guys or summing up these guys. It shouldn't matter how you measure those projectors. And therefore, the value that you assign to A, which is just a function of the values you assign to those pi A's, should also be independent of whether it's being measured together with B or together with C. Okay, so I've given you 4 different ways of characterizing this assumption. You'll find all these different ways described in the literature. And every one of them is nice because they give you different ways of proving a contradiction. So let me prove a contradiction using this latest version. I like to call this the algebraic approach because often it makes use of products or Hermitian operators. So the first key thing is that if you have a functional relationship among commuting Hermitian operators, then it has to be respected by their values. So if I have a bunch of operators, they all commute, and they satisfy some function, some functional relation, then the values I assign to those guys have to satisfy the same function. And the proof is straightforward. If you ask, what are the sets of eigenvalues that I could simultaneously assign to all these different Hermitian operators? Well, they're just specified by the joint eigenstates of those Hermitian operators. And if I act the first equation on one of the joint eigenstates, I'm just going to pull out the second equation. That's because I'm just going to get the eigenvalues for each of these guys. So I'm going to derive that. OK, so here is Merman's magic square proof of contextuality. So it's a proof in four dimensions. It involves two qubits. And it's one of the simplest proofs that you'll find. It involves these nine Hermitian operators. Okay, so the task is to assign values to each of these nine Hermitian operators in such a way that the value assigned to this guy, for example, is independent of what context it's measured in. Now, what you can prove is that these three operators in this row, they all commute with one another. That's pretty straightforward, because this is an operator on the first qubit, this is an operator on the second qubit, and this is just their tensor product. So they have to commute. So I can measure them simultaneously. So I should be able to simultaneously assign values to these guys. But if you look at the first column, I also have three operators that all commute with one another. But this corresponds to measuring a different basis from this. So the assumption of non-contextuality is that the value assigned to this operator should be independent of whether it's measured with these guys. So this is like A and B. And this is like A and C, and the value should be independent of that. And this is set up so that every row is a commuting set. So the only non-trivial one is the last row, but you can verify that these three guys commute. And the last column is also non-trivial, but you can verify that those guys commute. And so for every one of these guys, there's two ways of measuring it. And then you notice that if you take the products across the rows, you always get identity, because any poly operator squared, I guess I didn't say that. I'm using this notation for poly operators. So this is the sigma x and the sigma y and the sigma z poly operators. If I take that poly operator squared, I get identity. So this each of these equations is just squares of poly operators, so they're all identity. And if I multiply down the columns, I get identity for this, identity for this. And then these three guys actually multiply to minus identity. OK, so remember that the values that you assign to identity is always 1, because some outcome has to occur. So here's what we can say about the values we have to assign to these guys. First of all, we assume that there's a fixed value for a given observable x1, regardless of how it's measured. So when I consider it in this measurement or in this measurement, it's the same value. That's non-contextuality. I'm assigning the values 1 and minus 1 to these identity operators. And then I'm just saying that the product, the functional relationship that holds among these commuting Hermitian operators also has to hold among their values. That's what I derived on the last slide. So I get all these equations out of my assumption of non-contextuality. And now I can easily derive a contradiction. Can anyone see it? You see it? That is, what do you mean?
The measurement outcome is minus 1 at the same time, also 1.
No. What this says, so this equation here tells me that if I multiply the value assigned to x1, x2, y1, y2, and z1, z2, so if I multiply the values assigned to these three guys, they should multiply to minus 1. Because each of these poly operators has eigenvalues plus and minus 1, each of these values is going to be just plus or minus 1. I didn't say that explicitly. I should have. And so this equation just tells me that whatever values are assigned to these three guys by our deterministic hidden variables, they should multiply to minus 1. Because I have this equation that holds among the Hermitian operators, and any functional relationship that holds among Hermitian operators has to hold between their values as well. And 1 is just the value assigned to identity. And so this is just a statement about the product of these guys. So is that Does that answer your question, or?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
You have this on
You're saying you can't find plus or minus, you can't find an assignment of plus or minus one to each of these nine operators such that you satisfy all these conditions.
Yes.
I agree. And the question is why?
So you multiply the first three equations and the last three equations together, you should get the same thing.
Why is that?
You end up with a product of all the same measurements.
Okay, good. So you're saying
if I
multiply, say I just wrote V in front of each of these guys, then multiplying the three rows, all the elements in the three rows, and multiplying all the elements in the three columns gives me the same product.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so the product of all these guys should equal the product of all these guys?
Yes.
But, cool. And why does it not?
No.
You don't know? You're there. I think you know the answer. You just haven't told me where the contradiction comes from. Well, what do these equations tell you about the product of all these guys?
Minus 1 is not equal to 1, is I think what you want to hear.
Yeah, that's what I want to hear. Thank you. Right. You have to be explicit. So these guys, if I multiply all three of them, I just multiply, they all multiply the minus 1, and if I multiply all these guys, they multiply the plus 1, and that's your contradiction. Another way of seeing it is that if you take the product of all the left-hand sides here, then every one of these appears twice, and they're plus or minus 1 values, so when I square them, I get plus 1. So the product of the left-hand sides of all of them is clearly plus 1, whereas the product of the right-hand side of all of them is clearly minus 1. Okay, so that's a very simple and elegant proof that you can't have this kind of invariable model. If you have time to store it today, one of the questions you'll be answering is closely connected to this phenomenon. So I'm not clear you'll get around to seeing it, but there's a close connection with this stuff. Okay, so let me make a couple of comments on locality, and then I'll stop. So it turns out that Bell's notion of local determinism is a kind of non-contextuality. Okay, it's just that it's a lack of dependence on context when the context is remote. So you could say, well, you know, it'd be nice if the way I model a particular outcome of measurement is independent of what other things it's measured together with. But if those other choices, those differences, are far away, space-like separated, then it's not just nice, but you know, it's sort of required by local determinism that the way I model this should be independent of what's going on over there. So let's see that. So in the Bell proof, if you measure the spin along some axis little a on the first system and do nothing on the second, and then on the second system you measure spin along the axis little b or little b prime, then what you're really doing is measuring this Hermitian operator together with this one or together with that one. So that's exactly like our A commutes with B and A commutes with C, but B and C don't commute with one another. And therefore, non-contextuality tells me that the value I assign to this operator should be independent of what's being, whether this is measured with this operator or this guy. That's just what I've said here. And therefore, the value that I assign to this guy is the same for each of these two contexts. But that's exactly what Bell's assumption of local determinism is. It says the value you get depends only on stuff on the backward light cone, and it can't depend on choices that are made at some space-like separated location. So in a sense, non-contextuality, the traditional notion, is a more generic constraint than is locality. Locality is a particular kind of non-contextuality. It's an independence on a particular kind of context, namely a remote context. And therefore, every proof of the impossibility of a locally deterministic model is also a proof of the impossibility of a non-contextual model. So every proof of Bell's theorem is a proof that you can't have non-contextual invariables. The second connection is that sometimes you can justify an assumption of non-contextuality using locality. So consider the following setup. I mean, locality to most people seems like the more solid assumption, that you know, locality is something that we really ought to have, whereas non-contextuality, most people would say, is, well, yeah, that would have been nice if we could have had that, but it's not as important to have as locality. And this is just showing that sometimes if I give you a proof of the impossibility of a non-contextual model, you can turn it into a proof of Bell's theorem. Because your assumption of non-contextuality, the assumption that's eventually contradicted, can be justified by locality. So here's an example. Consider the proof that we saw in the beginning. And so it's a proof on a four-dimensional Hilbert space. And now imagine preparing two of these four-dimensional systems in this maximally entangled state. So, you know, one tensor one plus two tensor two plus three tensor three plus four tensor four. And you just imagine that one of these 18 rays is going to be measured, chosen at random and measured here, and one of them is going to be chosen at random measured over on the right. And now quantum mechanics says that if you happen to be measuring the same ray, you'll definitely get perfect correlations. So that's a really tough constraint for the hidden variables, because it means that they're going to have to use deterministic strategies, right? If there's any randomness in what this hidden variable assigns to a particular ray, it won't always generate correlation with the other side if it happens to be the same. So you're going to so there's going to be some local instructions that are going to have to assign a definite value, one or zero, to every ray. And it has to be independent of the context. Because again, if on the right-hand side that same ray is measured and the guy on the right is prepared to answer one, then this guy has to answer one to generate the perfect correlation, regardless of the context it falls in. And so what it means is that in order to get that perfect correlation, this guy is going to have deterministic, non-contextual values for each of the rays. But that's exactly what we proved was not possible. And therefore, you can't satisfy those correlations. And so if you observe them, you rule out a non-contextual value assignment. Okay. That's it. And I think I'll stop there. And next time, we'll talk about the more general notion. Yes?
Non-contextuality is telling us something about that we cannot say certain counterfactual statements, even in a very local setting.
It is all about counterfactuals, really. It says that you can't sort of have an identity across counterfactual worlds. So you can't imagine modeling something in the hidden variable model in the same way when you change certain facts about the context. There's a really simple and beautiful example by Ernst Becker, this paper from 1960. He gives an example of contextuality that doesn't actually arise in quantum theory, but it's the simplest possible example. I really like it. So he says, imagine you've got three measurements you can do on a system. Any pair of them can be done jointly, but the three cannot be done jointly. So you have to choose whether you can do 1 and 2, 2 and 3, or 1 and 3. It's possible, there's no logical contradiction to say that whenever you do some pair of measurement, you always get anti-correlated outcomes. So these are all two outcome measurements. So imagine you do measurements 1 and 2, your outcomes are anti-correlated, 0, 1, or 1, 0. And if you do 2 and 3, your outcomes are anti-correlated. And similarly with 1 and 3. But then it's really clear, so if I use dashed lines to denote anti-correlation, you know, if I try to assign values, I can get anti-correlation here, anti-correlation there, but then clearly I have correlation on the third layer. There's no way with deterministic values I could generate three anti-correlations. But there's no logical contradiction in saying that, you know, because you can only do one of those three measurements, it could very well be that every time you do it, you find anti-correlated outcomes. What it says is that if you imagine that there are deeper values that determine what the outcome is, then that value is going to have to depend on what it's being measured together with. It would have to be zero in this context and one in that context. So this is the core of all these proofs. The proofs I gave you are more complicated because there's no quantum example that fits this description.
You should probably start in 15 past 1.
Sorry for...
Whoa.
We'll start later because we want to have a break.
Can we start 1:30? You can start later, but those of you who are going to Pedro's lecture...